Thank you. Hello, everyone. So today I'm excited to talk to you about the nonlinear dynamics of space-time and some of the work that's being done in this area, both to deepen our understanding of the theory, as well as to best interpret all the exciting new observations we're making of extreme gravity, and perhaps foretell some of the ways we can use these observations to probe fundamental aspects of physics. Strong gravity plays a central role in a wide variety of settings. So I say my research and the research of my colleagues is best encapsulated in a sort of constellation of questions regarding the nonlinear dynamics of space-time and the strong field regime. And so along with a set of particular methods that have proved powerful in addressing these questions. So these kinds of questions go from, or sort of cover a wide range of topics, which I won't be able to address fully in my talk, going from things like early universe cosmology, addressing questions like the role of inhomogeneities on the onset of inflation, going to fundamental questions in GR, when does GR break down, for example, ranging to astrophysics and the dynamics of compact object mergers. However, I'd say that given that we're now in this exciting age of gravitational wave and multi-messenger astronomy, some particularly timely questions include what does GR predict and how well does it match our observations? How do the dynamics of extreme matter play out on dynamical space-time? And how can we use gravity to probe new physics? And I really say that as the observations get better and better, they really demand that we have better and better answers to these kinds of questions. So we've come a long way since the first observations of gravitational waves back in 2015. So this image here shows the 90 or so gravitational wave events that the LIGO-Virgo-Kagra collaboration has detected. You can see that most of them correspond to two black holes merging to create a bigger black hole. So those are represented by the blue dots, the black holes. A few of them we think correspond to two neutron stars merging together. So those are indicated by these orange dots here. And a few of them we believe correspond to a neutron star merging with a black hole. So, you know, really these observations are unveiling new populations of these compact objects, and we expect many more as our detectors become more sensitive and the number of detectors increases. But of course, both in being able to pick out these signals from the noisy gravitational wave data and in being able to interpret them and tell what they say about the underlying systems that gave rise to them, we need a good theoretical understanding of gravity. In particular, in order to calculate what happens in sort of the final violent stages as two black holes come together and merge to create a bigger black hole, we need numerical relativity to complement analytical and phenomenological waveform modeling. And these kinds of numerical relativity simulations of compact object mergers have become routine now. There are now catalogs that have thousands of example waveforms. But we shouldn't forget that this is a sort of relatively recent development, in the sense that it was only back in 2005 that the first such calculations of black hole mergers were done. So a little bit later in this talk, I'll discuss how some of the challenges that made solving the binary black hole problem in GR hard have to be revisited when we think about modifying general relativity even a little bit. I should also mention that it's a somewhat deep theoretical result that we're able to use GR to make these kinds of predictions anyway, given the fact that the Einstein's equations are breaking down, things are blowing up inside the black hole interiors. So this property that singularities are hidden from asymptotic observers goes by the name of the cosmic censorship conjecture. And so far, we've found it to hold in all the settings we studied, including recently in a rather extreme case of gravitational collapse of some asymmetric matter configuration like shown here, which for quite a while was held up as a putative counterexample. But again, this seems to be a rather unique property of GR that doesn't necessarily hold once you modify the theory. So now we have all these great observations that we can compare to our predictions. So here I'm showing you the famous first gravitational wave event that was seen by LIGO. You can see the increasing amplitude and frequency of the signal as two black holes come closer and closer together. And then they merge, creating this remnant black hole that settles down to its stationary state and exhibits this quasi-normal ringing. So in general relativity, both the frequency and the decay time of all the quasi-normal modes are uniquely determined by the black hole's mass and spin, provided you're in the regime where they can be treated as linear perturbations to the black hole. And so for this reason, there's a lot of interest in using measurements of these quasi-normal modes, both to tell you about the remnant properties and sort of as a clean test of general relativity, in the case that you can measure multiple quasi-normal modes. However, there's still a lot of debate regarding how long after this remnant black hole is formed you have to wait until you can treat this quasi-normal ringing using linear perturbation theory. And as you might imagine, that affects how detectable these modes are, since they're all decaying with time. So this plot here is from one example study where we looked at a particular nonlinear effect and its impact on the ring down, namely the effect of the black hole's mass and spin changing, and showed that during the early ring down, it will have a non-negligible impact. So we'll return to this ring down in a little bit. But I should also mention that right now we're living in the age not only of gravitational wave, but of multi-messenger astronomy. So in some cases, we've seen gravitational events and then followed them up with a whole host of telescopes. So the most spectacular example of that, of course, is GW170817, the neutron star merger event. And for that case, following about 2 seconds after the gravitational wave signal, we saw a short gamma ray burst and then a whole host of other electromagnetic transients going all the way up to the radio band. Of course, even with these spectacular observations, there still remain a lot of questions. In particular, what exactly happened in these 2 seconds in between where the gravitational wave became too high frequency to be detected, and then we started seeing all the subsequent electromagnetic transients. So again, this is one of the places where theory, and in particular numerical relativity simulations, can sort of help fill in the gaps. So as an example of this, one way the electromagnetic transients might help is that they can be sensitive to properties of the binary that the gravitational waves are not currently sensitive to, and where so far we've been sort of relying on our prior assumptions. So an example of that is shown here, which was from a study of the merger of spinning neutron stars. And that work showed that basically, if you consider neutron star spin, that can enhance the amount of matter you get that's dynamically unbound from the system, and that ends up in an accretion disk. And this is what powers the optical transient known as a kilonova that was, for example, seen after GW170817. And so currently, the gravitational waves or observations are not that sensitive to neutron star spin. And in fact, they're actually degenerate with other parameters. So this could give us extra information. Another example is black hole neutron star systems. So far, we've been sort of relying on our assumptions about the fact that compact objects below a certain mass should be neutron stars. But sort of the smoking gun that would actually tell us for sure that such an object as a neutron star would be to see an electromagnetic signal for a black hole neutron star event. So this study is an example of a transient might get in that case. In particular, it showed that if the neutron star has a significant magnetic field, its interaction with the black hole could actually give rise to a precursor electromagnetic signal to actually precede the merger. So I hope I've convinced you that gravitational wave and multi-messenger observations are sort of already revolutionizing our understanding of the astrophysics of compact object mergers. But sort of for the rest of my talk, I want to focus on how such observations might also inform our understanding of fundamental physics. And in particular, I'm going to discuss two examples of this. So the first one is considering modifications to general relativity. In particular, I'm going to discuss solving the full equations of motion for compact object mergers and the class of modified theories that give rise to second-order equations of motion. And the second example I will discuss is searching for ultralight vector bosons using black hole superradiance. In particular, some recent work developing accurate waveform models for these and designing sensitive searches, as well as some work studying the impact of nonlinear interactions on superradiance and how this can change the dynamics. So the observations are already probing these things, but sort of a reoccurring theme throughout this talk is the importance of a good theoretical understanding of these observational signatures in order to sort of design the most sensitive searches and in order to be able to place stringent constraints if you don't see a signal. And through a lot of work, we're making a lot of improvements here, but I'd say this is still sort of a place where the theory is lagging behind the observations, and there's a lot of opportunity. We live in this exciting time where we can now begin to test general relativity using this completely new way of looking at the universe, gravitational waves. So as an example of that, I have an abstract from a previous round of the LIGO-Virgo results, testing general relativity with binary black hole catalog. So I've highlighted a few of the example kinds of tests performing here. So varying post-Newtonian coefficients, mass of the graviton, deviations away from the curve frequency. So it's great that we're able to perform all these new tests of gravity in a somewhat theory agnostic way. But I would say that in some sense you could consider these tests strawmen of sorts, in the sense that for most of these deviations, we don't actually have a complete theory that would give you this alternative prediction. And that's for good reason, in the sense that there are very few modified gravity theories that are sort of on equal theoretical footing to GR, in the sense that they can give you a complete prediction for what happens when two compact objects merge. So ideally, when we consider modified gravity theories, we like to choose theories that have some physical motivation for the modifications they introduce, but also that have some phenomenological impact that we can probe with observations in the near future while still obeying all the observational constraints that have been made so far. We also ideally like to consider theories that can give complete predictions for things like black holes merging, since that's what we're observing right now. For this talk, I'm going to mainly concentrate on the sort of thorny issues raised by this last point. And I'd say that I don't know of a modified gravity theory that would sort of get full marks for every single item on this wish list. So some of the theories that I'm going to discuss today could be considered strawmen of sorts. But I'd say that the point here is that these strawmen can sort of walk and talk, in the sense that you can ask the theory for a complete prediction for what happens when two black holes merge together. And I'd say that there's a sort of pressing need even to have a few example modified theories where we come up with these kinds of predictions in order to sort of provide a proving ground for these more theory agnostic tests, and to make sure that we're actually designing the most sensitive searches and we're not just testing deviations that can't even consistently be realized in theory. So the reason we can make predictions with general relativity is that general relativity in a suitable formulation forms a well-posed initial value problem. So that's a result that actually goes back to Choquet-Brouhaha in the 1950s. And the original result is for the harmonic formulation, where you require the box or the covariant wave operator of the coordinates to be zero. And actually a variation of this formulation was actually used to perform the first binary black hole simulations that were successful. However, today I'm going to discuss theories that modify the principal part of the Einstein equations. That's the highest derivative terms, and where this result no longer holds. And there's been relatively less progress for such modified theories, basically due to the lack of a well-posed initial value problem for them. And I'm not going to give you the precise mathematical definition, but roughly speaking, if you take some theory that's not well-posed, you specify some initial data, and then you consider making sort of an arbitrarily small perturbation to that initial data, but you make it arbitrarily high frequency, that perturbation will blow up arbitrarily fast. So it's really a requirement for a mathematically sensible or for a classical theory to sort of make sense for it to be well-posed. For example, if you and I choose the same initial conditions up to 10 digits, but then we take something different from the 11th digit, we'll get wildly different answers.
Can I ask a question, Will?
Yes.
Thank you. So just to understand, so are you trying to study a theory which is almost GR and there is a small first correction to the effective field theory? Or are we trying to study a theory which is really very different from GR because all curvatures are important?
More the former, where you have GR and then some corrections. Yeah.
Okay, and I always thought that these corrections, are they generated quantum mechanically or it's some... Is it realistic to expect to ever measure? I thought they were super tiny, that it would be just basically impossible to ever measure. Maybe I'm wrong. Can you just comment a little bit? Is there some estimate of how big we expect them to be and whether it's realistic to expect to measure this? Maybe I'm wrong.
I would say my sort of philosophy is, we think GR is a good theory. I mean, we don't necessarily have a reason to expect corrections at one particular length scale, but right now we're observing gravity in the new regime. We have observations and we want to test them. So my philosophy is just want to come up with some example theories. If you believe that GR is good all the way down to the Planck scale, then of course you might not be surprised if you don't see any deviations from GR with gravitational waves. But we're making the observations and sort of my goal here is to come up with some examples of what we might see in some consistent theory.
Okay, thank you.
Could I follow up on that question?
Sure.
If you're treating these as effective theories where the modifications to GR are some small correction, then why do we need to impose second-order equations of motion?
I'm trying to convince you here that if we want to sort of have a classical theory that actually gives us predictions, we need a well-posed formulation. So I'll discuss a little bit more the importance of second-order equations. But even restricting to the subclass of second-order equations, it's a hard problem, and I don't think anyone knows how to do it for higher-order equations.
I think the question is, there's some similar principle that restricts the Lagrangian to only those that have second-order equations. The answer is no.
Right, but yeah, but.
So that means that this theory is sometimes unstable, but nothing protects it from generating all the other.
Yeah, so I haven't quite got to the modified theories, that I'm going to talk about. But.
Do you mind repeating the question? I could not hear the question.
I think the question was, is there any reason you expect to only have second order equations of motion? And if you just have some arbitrary correction to GR, can that give rise to higher order equations of motion? And I think yes, for some arbitrary correction to GR, that's true. But in this talk, I'm going to restrict to ones that do give you second order equations of motion, basically, because there we can make some progress on actually getting some predictions from such theories.
From the action point of view, those terms often are formulated as an additional degree of freedom, as the most kind of term. So you try to avoid them or restrict your theory.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you have higher order ones, you also run into this Ostrogradsky instability and so on.
And you have to treat it as an effect. And then there goes on some very short distance scale, not the scale.
Yeah, but in order to actually make predictions, you need a well-posed formulation.
Yeah.
And
the way you should do it is you need a higher negative term to perturbation.
Could you repeat the question / comment? It's very hard to follow otherwise.
No, I don't want to repeat.
Okay. Sorry, do you have any more questions, Pedro, or should I move on?
Yeah, I'm still a little bit confused about whether we are doing perturbation theory, treating things as a small perturbation, or whether we are going to solve a new type of nonlinear equations where we use some curvatures. But then it's a bit strange why do we use some curvatures and not all curvatures, or what would be the rules
right.
of the game?
Yeah, so I think
what terms to add and what terms not to add, it looks a bit arbitrary.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, I hopefully we'll address this in the next couple slides. The idea is we are going to solve the full equations for our modified theory. That's the idea. To solve the full nonlinear equations. And to do that, we're going to focus on a particular subclass of modified theories we can make progress. And a couple motivations are for this are first to compare it to other approximations that you might be able to use for other more generic theories that do have higher order equations of motion, so that you could use to address those in some approximation. We can sort of see how well those approximations do. And also just, as I mentioned, to sort of start to sharpen these more theory agnostic searches for deviations from GR. So maybe I can-
Thank you.
Okay.
One last thing, I think Lee had a question. He wrote in the chat question, but I don't know if he's waiting for someone to call on him.
I was very quick. Can you test any theories which are not symmetric on a time reversal?
Time reversal.
Can you test any theories that are not symmetric under time reversal? So I guess the methods I'm going to discuss today are particularly for ones that are scalar tensor theories that give you second order equations of motion. So if you have like higher derivative terms that would break that time reversal, they don't work there. Okay. Yeah, so there have been a number of different approaches that have been proposed in the past few years for evolving a modified theory and some deformation of a numerical GR simulation. One of them is the it's called the order reduction formulation. And so the idea here is you solve corrections order by order. And so you take your equations of motion, expand them in some small coupling, controlling the size of the modified gravity terms. And at each order, you do this in such a way that you have the same principal part of the Einstein equations. So you have a well-posed formulation that way. Unfortunately, that's been shown to suffer from Seckler effects that basically accumulate on the radiation reaction timescale of your binary. So it's hard to use those to get any sort of accurate predictions for the gravitational wave signal. Another approach that's been made is to basically take your theory and modify its short wavelength behavior in such a way that you recover a well-posed problem while trying to retain the desired long wavelength behavior. So that's something that Louise and his collaborators have been pursuing. But sort of a challenge there is that you need to introduce these new short timescales, and you want to make them sufficiently short so that they don't affect the answer you get, but not so short that your computation becomes prohibitively expensive or your equations are starting to break down. So the approach I'm going to discuss today is just solving the full equations of motion for a modified theory. And so in that case, you don't have to worry about errors that come in from secular or non-perturbative effects. But you know, really the challenge here is that you have to revisit some of the things that made solving the binary black hole problem in NGR hard, in the sense of finding well-posed formulation for a given theory. And in fact, first you need to identify such a theory where you can do it. And even within that theory, particular regions of parameter space where you can find a well-posed formulation. So I would say for quite a while, it was not clear that one could even do this, solve the full equations for things like black holes merging in modified theories that modify the principal part of the Einstein equations. But recently, our collaborator Justin Ripley and I decided to try to tackle this question, in part motivated by some interesting results in the mathematical GR literature. And basically found that we can do this for some interesting regime when it might have observational impact on black hole mergers that we're seeing. So the particular class of theories that we decided to focus on are scalar tensor theories that give rise to second order equations of motion. So those are known as Hordinsky theories. You can see the Lagrangian depicted here in painting form. It's actually a painting by Gregory Hordinsky himself. He was actually a professor at University of Waterloo. And he, a couple years after he got tenure, he left to pursue art, which is maybe something I'm not supposed to mention in this kind of talk. And we're also, so in this evolution scheme that Justin and I introduced, we're also making use of this new modified harmonic formulation that was introduced a couple years ago by Kovacs and Riel, and that is applicable to these this class of theories. And what they're able to show is that if you're in the limit where the length scale introduced by the modifications to GR is much, much shorter than all your relevant length scales in your problem, if you're in that limit, then their formulation will be well posed. However, once you sort of go away to the limit where you're having some non-negligible impact, you might be able to have an impact on the kind of binaries you're seeing. You know, there's no theorem to protect you. You're sort of working without a net. What we found is that it does work in an interesting part of this regime as well. So I won't go into all the technical details. The sort of challenges that come about with trying to tackle these more complicated and different equations. I'll just mention one thing that we found crucial to carrying out these evolutions, which is to excise a region within the black hole interiors. And so that has to be done even more aggressively than it's done in general relativity. And the reason for that is that the equations are actually breaking down and becoming ill-posed within the black hole. And as you turn up the coupling, the regions where they are not well-posed becomes closer and closer to the horizon. And in fact, if you make the coupling too high, that region exceeds the black hole horizon. And then the theory can't be used to make predictions. And so here you don't have this nice cosmic censorship property to protect you. To focus on a concrete example, we decided to look at the theory with the Lagrangian given here. So this Lagrangian could be motivated from some particular effective as arising in some particular gradient expansion as an effective field theory. But in particular, we're going to simplify things even further and set these potential and this alpha term to zero and just consider the simplest form for this term beta, which is that beta is some coupling parameter lambda, which has dimensions of length squared, times phi, multiplying g here, which is called the Gauss-Binet curvature. It's given by this particular combination of the Riemann tensor. So this theory is known as the shift-symmetric Einstein scalar Gauss-Binet. And it's a, you know, a representative example of Hordinsky theory that differs from GR qualitatively in several ways. You know, you've modified the principal part. Your equations are now fully nonlinear, and it can violate things like the null convergence condition. So black holes can actually have their area shrink in this theory. This theory has also attracted a lot of attention in the literature because it gives rise to black hole solutions that have scalar charge. So we can give new phenomenology for black holes while evading weak field tests. And you know, because of this attention that it's received, there are a number of results in the literature we can compare to, including post-Newtonian results and stationary solutions for black holes. I'm going to show
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Is there some symmetry that allows me to restrict to this type of terms in the effective action, or is this action very fine-tuned?
So here you're assuming that it's parity invariant, and then this is the one you get.
For example, G is this very precise combination of curvatures. It's not just parity, right? I mean, you are.
Basically, this particular action is motivated as, including four derivative terms that obey parity invariants and then doing field rate definitions. So I think this is similar to this effective field theory that Weinberg proposed for deflation. But then you get some parity, some terms that violate parity, and then if you get rid of those, you reduce to this.
I see. So with this order of curvatures, it's more or less generic up to four derivatives. I see.
Yeah,
but there is an important point that this combination is topological if lambda was zero. So that's a special Gauss-Poinet combination, right? I don't know. Yeah.
If there were no scalar dependent coefficient multiplying this, it would just be a total derivative. You could ignore it.
Can I follow up on that a little bit? I know that the field redefinitions and stuff can reduce to this action, but is there an argument that allows you to set alpha equals zero?
No. My argument here is just to make things simple. So basically that we have one parameter that we can vary. But the methods I'm going to talk about should be applicable when alpha is non-zero. And so you can start to look in those two once you sort of explore the impact of lambda. But I think for binary black hole mergers and the things I'm going to talk about, this term is sort of the key term that gives rise to new phenomenology. But then we can, and people have started exploring the impacts of alpha as well.
I see, thank you.
Yep, so I'm gonna show you some results from binary black hole mergers and binary neutron star mergers to show you that these methods work and some lessons that we can learn by looking at a few examples. So here's an animation from some a binary black hole simulation. Actually, in some work led by my PhD student, Max Korman. So you can see, this is equal mass binary black hole. As I mentioned, these black holes have scalar charge, and in fact, they emit scalar radiation, which causes the end spiral to happen faster. They merge, creating a bigger black hole, actually has less scalar charge, because it's less affected by these smaller length corrections. So we can look at the gravitational waves from doing a number of these calculations for different mass ratios and different couplings. So in this top panel here, you can see the dephasing in the gravitational wave signal as you change this coupling. So here, this zeta is just proportional to the lambda parameter I mentioned. So zeta equals zero is GR. And then as you turn out this coupling, the end spiral happens faster and faster due to this extra scalar radiation. You can see the dephasing in the gravitational waveform. This bottom plot here is basically the accumulated phase that you get between some frequencies and comparing what we get in the simulations to what is predicted by post-Newtonian. So the takeaway here is that even summing up several different terms, the leading and subleading terms in post-Newtonian, post-Newtonian does not adequately capture the D phase, and you get this late in spiral regime.
Is it the way things work is that you start with two Schwarzschild like initial condition and then far away and then let it evolve to the modified
Yeah. So basically, you know, for a given mass and coupling, the black hole, there'll be a certain charge that the black hole will have. They'll give you a stationary solution. So for kind of technical reasons, we just start with a vacuum solution and then wait a little bit and it'll settle to these charged black hole solutions. But I mean, obviously you should imagine that that's just a transient from the initial conditions. But yeah, the particular charge configuration is not a free parameter. It's just set by the coupling and the black hole mass. Yeah, and so we can also look at the merger gravitational wave signal. So that's shown here. So here I'm now aligning the gravitational waves in time and phase of the peak. And here you can see the effect is rather small. For example, on the ring down, you know, basically for different couplings, there's some small effect, but it's you know, hard to reliably pick out from our simulation. And that's just because the final black hole is bigger compared to the constituents, so it's less affected by the modified gravity. And also the effect on the peak amplitude is small. And that's actually in contrast to what was found with some other approximations, for example, this order reduction method. So I can also mention that there's no reason we can't use these same methods to tackle binary neutron stars. And so one particular reason you might be interested in binary neutron star mergers is that they can create black holes of around 3 solar masses, which is small compared to other known astrophysical channels for black hole formation. Sort of a generic feature of Einstein's Galois-Gauss-Bay and other theories is that they introduce corrections at some length scale and below. And so they're most sensitive to the smallest curvature scales and therefore to the smallest black holes. So I'll show you some results here, basically showing that even though there'll be, for neutron stars, there'll be not a strong impact on the N spiral because neutron stars in this theory don't have scalar charge in contrast to black holes. And we're not considering any extra coupling between the sort of non-minimal coupling of the neutron star matter in the Einstein frame, that you will still have a big effect on the post-merger of these neutron star mergers. And this happens even for values of this coupling that are sort of below the ones being probed by current observations of binary black holes. So here's an animation from two neutron stars merging. So on the left, we have the matter density. On the right is the scalar field. Initially, it's small because the neutron stars don't have charge. So the stars are inspiring, and then they merge. And then they create this black hole, which then develops a scalar charge.
Hey, Will.
Yes.
Why are they not charged if they have a scalar profile? It looked like they had some profile pre.
Yeah, so there's it's not like they have zero scalar field, but the scalar field falls off, much faster than 1 over R. So it's not a charge, yeah. Yeah, so you can see that for different couplings, there's sort of negligible impact on the N spiral, but then some impact on the sort of later part of the ring down signal. So you can see that in some more detail here, where I'm just showing you the log of the amplitude of the gravitational wave signal. And you can see that sort of as the quasi-normal mode decays exponentially, you have some impact on mainly its amplitude as you change the coupling. And that's because the black hole, as it forms, is developing this scalar charge that's shown on this top panel and settling down on sort of similar timescales to which the ring down occurs. So that's sort of maybe a caution against these analyses that focus mainly on the effect that modified gravity will have on the frequency of the quasi-normal modes as opposed to on the amplitude. And it's also sort of a caution against trying to be too aggressive and starting to hit the peak of the gravitational waveform and fitting these quasi-normal modes in order to test GR. And if you, I should mention that if you you know, turn up the coupling more, it'll have more of an impact on the final black hole. But if you turn up significantly more, actually, your evolution will break down as the black holes form. So when two neutron stars come together, they don't have to immediately form a black hole. In some cases, they, you know, depending on the equation of state and the total mass, they might form a remnant star. So here's an example where that happens. So again, we have density on the left and the scalar field on the right. And what we'll see is, as the two stars come together, they'll create this post-merger remnant that'll undergo oscillations, and this will actually give you enhancement in the scalar field. So you can see it's actually growing quite large. I mean, it's almost approaching order one in these units of the Planck mass. And it's actually at this point that our evolution breaks down.
Yes. So can I ask a question?
I think Louise had first.
OK.
But yeah.
Yeah, so just curious, on that case where you kind of look at the coupling as large as you can till something bad happens, if you go a little bit before that, does the tidal log number get significantly affected? That say something about gravitational wave constraints on it?
Yeah, it seems like it doesn't have that much impact on the n spiral because it really doesn't get enhanced until you have these like you know, high densities and oscillations that really source the Gauss-Poincaré curvature. Yeah, so we can see, sorry, go ahead. Yeah, she had a question too.
I was just wondering, I mean, given that you're introducing this huge scale of kilometers, which is, I mean, in terms of effective field theory cutoff is a very low energy scale. I mean, shouldn't this type of theory be testable on, I don't know, in colliders or something like other type of terrestrial experiments?
I think because it's really the curvature length scale, not just the length scale, right? So you need high curvature, you know, high space-time curvature at that scale. And so, yeah, I think for this particular theory, the best constraints are coming from observing compact objects.
Yeah, but I mean, like on nuclei have the same densities as neutron stars. Of course, you're not testing gravity on a scale of nuclei, but you have nuclear collisions of, I mean, nuclear collisions and things like that.
Yeah, but it's the curvature length scale, right? So you need strong gravity at those scales, basically.
But that's the part I'm asking, why do we need a strong gravity? Because it's not clear that we need a strong gravity to test this. What we need is large curvature, but so not metric fluctuations of order one, just curvatures that are large, which means large densities, basically.
Yes, it's because of this coupling to the Gauss-Binet curvature, right? So you need something that's a strong source of that.
We can talk more about this, but this is a question mark for me that maybe there are other ways of testing this. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, so in this plot, we can see a little bit in more detail what's going on, basically, by varying the coupling and see how this affects the scalar field. And so what you can see here is that it's actually a nonlinear enhancement due to the oscillations in the post-merger star to give rise to this enhancement of the scalar field, and actually evidence that it's blowing up and the theory is breaking down. And again, this is happening at couplings that are below the ones that are ruled out by observations of binary black holes.
Sorry, I think I'm still a little bit confused by the general philosophy. So if we are doing effective field theory and studying the first correction to GR, then, if I understood correctly, we should trust it to linear order, right? To first order. We should study a small effect and study it to linear order. As soon as you are saying that it's breaking down or it's becoming of order one, the effect of this term, then why would you be dropping all other terms, the next term and the next and the next and the next? As soon as you say that the second term that I added is of the same order as the first one, then you cannot drop any of the other terms. I'm a bit confused. Shouldn't you be able, in other words, if it's a small effect that we want to try to study, shouldn't we be able to just use the simulation that you did without this extra term and then do some kind of perturbation theory and study the small effect of this term? Studying the effect when it's becoming huge, it looks a bit counterintuitive, contradictory to the logic of effective field theory of this being a small term that we are adding.
Right. So yeah. So I have a couple different answers to that. Yeah. So first of all, I mean, I think maybe the approach that you're suggesting is more akin to this order reduction approach that I mentioned, where you know, basically you solve for GR, then you consider some field on that background, and then you consider how the linear perturbations that that would source. And that particular approach, you know, as I mentioned, you know, it seems like naively it should give you some interesting answers, but it actually suffers from this secular error effect, where basically you start to accumulate errors on your radiation reaction timescale, and basically you're not able to get reliable answers for that. So here, I mean, I would say that basically, you know, there's kind of a, you know, in this coupling, there's sort of a somewhat small range of parameters where, you know, the coupling is very small, you know, you have no impact on the gravitational waves. You turn it up some, you have some impact, and then you turn it more, and then the theory breaks down. And so in some sense, I would say, it's when the theory breaks down and loses well positiveness, you know, that's when we can say that the effective field theory is breaking down. So the sort of program here is to explore that range in between where it has some impact and where it breaks down. And of course, you know, the first thing we have to do in order to do that is sort of delineate those range of parameters where it starts, you know, where it has an impact and where it breaks down. So that's sort of what this is doing here. Okay, so yeah, so the kind of takeaway point here is that these post-merger remnants that form from neutron star mergers, whether they be black holes or neutron stars, can actually probe smaller curvature length scales, and therefore modifications at smaller scales compared to black holes. Of course, I should mention that sort of observationally speaking, you know, the gravitational waves from this phase are all at rather high frequency, where current detectors are not that sensitive to. You know, as I mentioned, we also have electromagnetic transients that are coming for this regime, though of course disentangling effects like this from all the other unknowns is an ongoing challenge. But sort of the main takeaway I have here is that we now have these tools to give complete answers to questions like, you know, what is the gravitational wave signal from a black hole merging in this class of theories, this broad class of theories, namely, you know, scalar tensor theories with second order equations of motion. And, you know, I would say we're sort of at the initial stages of exploring, but already, you know, we have some lessons that we can learn from these examples, in particular, how well various approximations that have been considered, you know, how accurate they are, as well as being able to sort of figure out how sensitive considering certain types of deviations from GR are and being sensitive to modifications. And I'd say going forward, you know, one of the directions for future work would be to sort of sharpen these comparisons and really try to use some of these example waveforms from benchmark theories as a way to, you know, come up with new and more sensitive theory-agnostic searches. And I should also mention that, you know, these ordinancy classes has also been considered in, you know, other regimes besides compact object mergers, for example, in cosmology, during inflation or dark energy, and these same methods could be used to tackle interesting questions there. Yeah, so that kind of completes the first section that I wanted to talk about. So now I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about another way that we can use gravitational waves to prove fundamental physics. And that's mainly looking for ultralight bosons through black hole superradiance. So normally, when we think of looking for new particles, we think of something like the Large Hadron Collider. You go to higher and higher energies to probe more and more massive particles that would be strongly coupled to ordinary matter. However, it's interesting to think about sort of the complementary part of parameter space that lives down here, which would be very light particles that are very weakly coupled to ordinary matter. So examples of things that live there are things like the axion proposed to solve the strong CP problem in quantum chromodynamics, dark photons, or other kinds of dark matter. And it turns out you can probe this part of parameter space just using spinning black holes and the phenomenon of super radiance. So massive bosons, whether they be scalars or vectors, can actually form bound states around black holes. And if the oscillation frequency of the cloud is less than m, where m is the azimuth number of the cloud, times omega h, the Rysen frequency of the black hole, then they actually can extract rotational energy from the black hole and grow exponentially in time. And this means that black holes can actually act as particle detectors for particles whose Compton wavelength is comparable to that of astrophysical black holes. And that's where this instability is the fastest. Assuming only gravitational interactions, the cloud will grow until it's spun down the black hole such that its horizon frequency matches the oscillation of the cloud, which means you can grow clouds that are up to a few percent of the mass of the black hole. And then the oscillations of this cloud will produce gravitational waves, like are shown here. And so this is for ultralight vector boson. And you can see that the gravitational waves looks pretty simple. They're, roughly speaking, monochromatic with slowly changing amplitude and frequency. So in this talk, I'm going to focus on the particular example of ultralight vectors. So compared to their scalar cousins, vectors are sort of the louder and faster ones. So because the ultralight vector clouds can sit closer to the black hole, they can go faster through super radiance and they can emit stronger gravitational radiation. So I was also surprised to learn that hip-hop artists also like to tweet papers about ultralight vectors. Maybe that also has something to do with the fact that they're faster and louder. So I should mention for everyone who's under the age of 35 that MC Hammer is a famous rapper who was big in the early 90s. So there's a number of different ways one might try to observationally go out and look for evidence of super radiance. So one of them is just measuring black hole spins to see if the black holes could have been subject to this instability. You can do that, for example, by observing accretion disks around black holes and trying to measure their spins that way. Another option is to try to detect the gravitational waves from these oscillating boson clouds. So one can consider doing blind searches for either a resolved or a stochastic background of gravitational waves coming from these oscillating clouds. So an example of that is shown here from some work where we basically looked for a stochastic background of gravitational waves coming from ultralight vectors using LIGO data. So from this plot, you can see that an instrument like LIGO is primarily sensitive to ultralight vector bosons in sort of the 10 to the minus 12, 10 to the minus 13 electron volt range. But I should say that a downside of all these blind searches is that if you don't see a signal, then in order to place constraints, you have to make assumptions about black hole population statistics, in particular the masses and spins of the black holes, which are not that well known. Sort of a more promising idea is to target specific black holes. So for example, we know that when two black holes merge, as in the kind of events that LIGO Virgo Kagra is seeing, it'll create a newly formed spinning black hole. And if we see the gravitational wave signal, we can have a very good idea what the black hole's mass and spin of this newly formed black hole will be. The sort of downside, so I guess those are particularly exciting because you both have the potential of making a discovery by observing those. And if you don't see anything, you can sort of place firm constraints that don't rely on black hole population statistics or, D detailed modeling of accretion disks or things like that. But sort of the downside there is that, you know, mergers are rare, and they typically happen at larger distances. So for that reason, these targeted searches have not yet been done. So the question that my collaborators and I set out to answer is, can we actually go out and look for ultralight vector bosons using these follow-up searches with the current generation of detectors? And to do that, you need a good model for the gravitational wave signal. These gravitational waves from ultralight boson clouds have sort of become the, you know, other source that continuous wave searches have been going after, in addition to things like mountains on neutron stars. And their frequency is not exactly monochromatic. It evolves a little bit. And that's basically due to the fact that the self-gravity of the cloud will cause a small decrease in the frequency of oscillation of the cloud, or redshift. And then as the cloud dissipates, this decrease will become less and less. So the frequency will increase, as shown here. So that's sort of the opposite of what you'd expect for a neutron star with a mountain, for example, which will spin down. This will increase in frequency. And it's this frequency evolution that actually limits being able to use sort of the standard continuous wave searches for these kinds of sources. So the typical continuous wave source search, assumes something like that the f dot, the frequency time derivative, is less than something like 10 to the minus 11 hertz per second. So recently, my students and I have been working on developing a relativistic waveform model for these signals that includes this frequency evolution, but is also, you know, fully relativistic and valid for the loudest signals, including scalars and vectors, so that, you know, we won't lose any sensitivity to sort of theoretical modeling errors, which would be a shame since we're putting all this time and effort into making the observations. So if you want, you can go download this waveform model. Its name is SuperRad. My students took a little convincing to realize that's a cool name, but they're on board now. And you can see an example waveform computed with this here for sort of parameters that would be typical of a merger remnant. So from this plot, you can see that the frequency and the amplitude of the gravitational wave signal are sort of evolving on timescales of tens of hours. So this would be sort of intermediate between a compact object merger coalescence and the sort of vanilla continuous wave source, where in the latter you might assume that the signal, you know, lasts the whole observing time. So in order to go after these, you need a new type of search. So recently we've been working with some experts in these kinds of continuous wave searches to come up with a new method that will take this frequency evolution into account. The method we came up with is to use this efficient search algorithm that basically divides the signal into coherence times, and where you assume basically that the frequency is some constant. But then in between each of these coherence times, you allow the frequency to evolve in a specified way. And you basically use your waveform model to inform what you choose for these coherence times and how you allow the frequency to change in between them in sort of the optimal way. So this plot on the left shows the ability of this search algorithm to pick out such a signal from the noise and capture its frequency evolution, at least up until the time when the amplitude becomes too low to be measured. This plot on the right basically shows how far you could see such merger remnants with LIGO at design sensitivity. And that's as a function of the black hole mass and the black hole spin. And you can basically see that for sort of the typical merger remnants that LIGO Virgo Kagra has been seeing, we can actually go out to horizon distances of gigaparsecs. It's pretty exciting. LIGO just started its fourth observing run about a week ago. So we're optimistic that sometime in the near future, we'll actually be able to do these follow-up searches. Yeah, so in my remaining time, I just want to mention one other sort of frontier of black hole superradiance, and that's the impact of nonlinear interactions. So if we assume ultralight boson that just interacts gravitationally, then the saturation of the sensibility will occur just due to back direction of the black hole, basically spinning it down. And what we found is that this saturation actually happens quasi-adiabatically, even for cases where you're considering relative physics cases, clouds close to the black hole, or you're considering cases where you're taking out 10% of the black hole's mass or so. However, if you have nonlinear interactions for your ultralight boson, either with itself or other fields, this can change the picture. So you could have, you might have some sort of radiation that halts the saturation, halts the growth of the instability, or you might have some explosive phenomena due to these nonlinear interactions. So in the specific context of the axion, this idea of having some explosive phenomenon was actually dubbed a Bose Nova by Meenan and collaborators, borrowing some terminology from Bose-Einstein condensates. And that's a bit of a play in words with the Brazilian genre of music, Bossa Nova, which I understand is a type of samba involving the classical guitar. But for the specific case of the axion, it looks like you might not actually get this Bossa Nova scenario. And that's just because basically scalar radiation sort of halts the exponential growth of the cloud before it gets too large to have anything sort of violent happens. However, lately I looked into the vector case, and there it turns out to be different. So to consider a concrete and rather natural example of nonlinear interactions for a vector boson, I'm considering a dark photon that gets its mass through the Higgs mechanism. So the idea is, similar to how standard model particles get their mass through the Higgs, we're considering a dark photon with a U1 symmetry that interacts with this complex scalar phi, which would be distinct from the standard model Higgs. And we take a form for the potential such that, that's given by this black curve here, ignoring the effects of the vector field. And with this potential, the complex scalar field wants to, sit at the bottom of its potential and have a non-zero vacuum expectation value, which I'm calling here V. Then this would give the dark photon a mass, and therefore it could undergo the superradiance stability and grow exponentially around clouds, around black holes. But as it grows larger and larger, it will actually start to back react on the complex scalar. And so if you consider the back reaction, it'll want to push the complex field towards smaller and smaller magnitudes, closer to its symmetry restoration value. And what I found is that when it exceeds some threshold set by the coupling parameters, it can actually, at some points within the cloud, go to zero, the symmetry restoration value, and then induce some nonlinear dynamics that halts the exponential growth of the cloud. So in fact, what happens is you form these string vortices. That is one-dimensional curves where the scalar field magnitude goes to zero. But if you look at the phase of the complex field going around the string, it goes through 2 pi. So I'm going to show you an animation here where I show you the phase of this complex field and the equatorial plane around the black hole. And so during this phase, the dark photon cloud is growing, and these green contours show the strings. So you can see one goes out, one immediately falls into the black hole, and the other one comes back to the black hole as well. And so this is sort of completely analogous to the cosmic strings that people consider, but here sort of dynamically formed around a black hole. So I can show you another animation, this time showing you the energy density in the cloud. So what you'll see is that as the string forms, they actually sort of mediate the disruption of the energy in the cloud. So there they form there. So a large amount of the energy is actually radiated away. Some of it falls back into the black hole, and then some remains in the cloud that sort of settles down, and then it can start growing again. So this is sort of similar in spirit to the Bose-Nev with Osprey in the Axion case, though the nonlinear dynamics are quite a bit different here. So I'm calling this a stringy Bosonova. You know, of course, in retrospect, it might make sense that to make Bosonova music, you need strings. So sort of the takeaway message here is that, for a range of parameters in this Higgs abelian model, you're basically changing the saturation, the superanisimilarity, and you now get this episodic burst-like behavior where the energy in the cloud can increase exponentially, then dramatically decreases, and then keep increasing again, basically as long as the black hole can power it. In some follow-up work, Jen Wu and I looked into some of the phenomenology of this vortex formation. And for different values of the coupling, where the sort of string radius would be much, much smaller than a cloud, which is a bit difficult to tackle with the simulations, you might actually expect to form a very large number of these strings, which would be relativistic and interacting. And you might actually expect to eject some of them. So they could then, depending on your parameters, decay through gravitational waves, giving rise to a different kind of gravitational wave signal. Or if they interact with ordinary matter, you might be able to detect them. And we also realized that this phenomenon of vortex formation would also be applicable to a different regime. That is, if you consider dark photon dark matter, where the dark photon got its mass in the same way, then in various protection mechanisms that people have considered, this vortex formation would happen and would sort of completely change the dynamics in a way that has to be taken into account when considering such models. Summarize this section on black hole superradiance. I've shown you how gravitational waves can be a sort of powerful probe for ultralight bosons, and in particular how we can leverage a good theoretical understanding of the expected gravitational waveform to perform more sensitive searches. And hopefully, in the near future, we'll be able to actually follow up merger remnants to look for these signals or place constraints without having to make assumptions about black hole population statistics or accretion dynamics or things like that. I also mentioned how coupling for nonlinear interactions for these ultralight bosons can give rise to interesting new dynamics, like the stringy Bosonova or new observables. So another example of that I didn't have time to talk about is what happens if you consider the dark photon to be kinetically mixed with the ordinary photon. So in some recent work that was led by my student Niels Simonsen, including a number of folks here at PI, Christina, Daniel, and Jin Wu, we actually looked into that and found that in such a case, you might actually expect to form a plasma around a black hole due to this dark photon cloud, which would give rise to a strong electromagnetic transient. So these could actually be multi-messenger sources. So yeah, that sort of brings me to the end of my talk. So I just want to say that I think now is a particularly exciting time for gravitational physics. Not only do we have all these new observations as the sensitivity and number of our detectors increases, but we also have a lot of demos on the theory side, and all the different regimes going from cosmology to compact object mergers. And I mentioned a few examples of how we might be able to use strong gravity to look for new fundamental physics. Though, of course, there's always the real possibility that we'll have some surprises as we make these completely new observations. And that, of course, be exciting to try to explain them. But I think there, again, all these theoretical tools that are being developed will be able to play a role. So thank you for your attention. And let me know if you have any other questions.
Any more questions? There are more online.
curious, so halfway through your talk, you showed that plot of gravitational wave stochastic background from super radiant mode.
Right.
Have you guys entertained the possibility of whether it could affect nanoscale frequencies for larger black holes? I guess not, but given what we keep hearing, that nanogram is coming with some announcement, I'm wondering if we should be thinking.
Yeah, that's a good question. So yeah, here I was focusing mainly on stellar mass black holes, but of course, a similar picture would hold for supermassive black holes, and there you would probe even smaller masses for ultralight bosons. But yeah, I haven't thought particularly about whether that would give a signal at the really low frequencies of nanograv or not.
Just a quick question about neutron star mergers.
Mm-hmm.
How much do we expect to learn regarding the equation of the state of the neutron stars? I mean, from
that's definitely one of the main things people are interested in trying to figure out with these kinds of observations. During the N-spiral of two neutron stars, the leading order effect of having a neutron star as opposed to a black hole is that you'll have these tidal effects on the neutron star, and that'll basically cause the N spiral to happen a little bit faster. And so basically, by looking at the late stage of the N spiral, we already have some constraints on different equations of state that would sort of give rise to very big neutron stars that would be very easily tidally deformed, and hopefully we'll have more neutron star merger observations in the future that will give even stronger constraints. Yeah, of course, that also has a huge effect on all the post-merger dynamics as well. Whether or not particularly whether or not you immediately form a black hole, or you have one of these long-lived remnants, as well as its oscillation frequency of the remnant and so on, which is pretty exciting. Though there, that's again at higher frequencies that we're currently less sensitive to.
One other question. And so there are all these different equivalent classical formulations of gravity, like the Cartan formulation in terms of spin connection and tetrad, or this Dia formulation, but they maybe suggest different ways about how you might modify GR. Do people ever try to numerically simulate GR in those other formulations? And if so, are there advantages or disadvantages?
To my knowledge, I don't know of anyone who's tried to numerically evolved GR in those particular formulations that you mentioned. That's an interesting question. I mean, definitely something we're learning here is that different formulations have different advantages. And like this modified harmonic formulation I mentioned, that might also, even just for GR, we're finding that it has some advantages in being able to sort of implement different gauge conditions that might be favorable for some different circumstances you're looking at. So yeah, that's an interesting question. Thanks.
Can I ask a question? Can you now, you said there was some problem, maybe it would be nice for me to learn a bit about it, with perturbation theory, we're just doing naive perturbation theory when the effect is small. And so you chose to do this full nonlinear evolution of your equations and so on. But now that you finished that, if the effect is small, could you fix what people were doing wrong with perturbation theory, or they were not doing anything wrong and it's really a conceptual problem?
That's a good question. I mean, so definitely one of the other things we want to do is use the full solutions we have for the class of theories where we know how to do that, and then compare it to various approximation methods that have been proposed, and see how big the errors there are, and maybe, as you said, figure out the best way to implement those approximation schemes, because then we could actually use them to tackle other theories, that have terms that we don't know how to handle because they don't fall into this class. So yeah, that's an interesting question.
But as you mentioned, people have looked at that in a particular theory in secular terms is completely
Yeah. So for this like naive order reduction approach, yeah, basically, you know, the problem is just, you know, even though the corrections are small, you're kind of integrating them over quote unquote long timescales, where that's just the radiation reaction timescale of your binary. So basically, the problem is that the errors you're introducing are just growing secularly.
Last question.
Do you need to keep? There is another question. I can stop. But do you need to keep more terms? If you keep more terms in your effective action, are your results sensitive to that, or you would really see that you put more terms and the results are the same?
I think this kind of this problem comes about. It's sort of independent of the number of terms you put in your action.
No, but I'm asking your simulation. If you put one more term, one more curvature in your simulation with a coefficient that is, I don't know, 1/4 of the ones that you put for your leading term, and then you run again the numerics, are the predictions that you're going to make, are they going to change by order one, or are they going to change less than they changed already?
Sorry, you're saying if I... For the...
So you go to your Lagrangian and you add some g. Now you add a term g squared. And the coefficient is 1/4 of the coefficient that you put for the term of order g. Will it affect the final result by an order one coefficient, or will it affect it by a tiny bit? In other words, are you controlling for your effort, for the fact that you are doing effective field theory? So you are only allowed to, you are not always allowed to truncate.
Yeah. Right,
sometimes
right.
You have to replace your ignorance by doing things by hand. I think it was one of the methods you described, right? That you said that Louis was doing. That when you reach scales that are very, very ultraviolet, you just parameterize your ignorance in some way, but you don't try to solve the equations there.
Right. So, you know, introducing those higher terms, you know, if you do that, then you're not able to use the methods that I discussed here, because, you know, those would you know, lead to equations that, you know, we don't yet know how to put in a well-closed formulation. But I think maybe to get to the spirit of your question, I mean, we are doing, you know, basically kind of by necessity, we are kind of working in the regime where these corrections for the modifications were sort of just a correction to GR. And basically, because when they start to become dominant, that's when we can't do the calculation anymore.
Okay, last question, Ghazal.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of related because all of this discussion is it really perturbative effective theory? Do you have a quantifiable way to say, for example, the correction is actually order one or the next correction? Is there something that you, like if you, for example, like the SEO, put back the solution into the action and quantify how much it is compared to the GR term. I don't know, like...
Yeah, I mean, so you could do like a rough calculation. I mean, so basically for like, you know, the...
Could you maybe repeat your question?
Yeah, so Ghazal is asking, can you quantify sort of how big the corrections that the modified GR is introducing? Because they should be sort of, in some sense, small in the correction. So yeah, I mean, basically, you know, just sort of naively, the length scales, which are the characteristic length scale of the modification, is always smaller than the characteristic size of the objects we're considering. Like, you know, kind of, you know, for some of the examples I'm considering, you're kind of thinking of corrections that, you know, kilometer length scales are below, and considering black holes that are, you know, tens of kilometers or bigger, roughly speaking. But I would say, you know, so you can have those sort of back of the envelope type calculations. But I'd say sort of, maybe the more rigorous definition of when your corrections are breaking down is just when you lose well-posedness in these formulations, which might even be, you know, sooner than those naive estimates would leave you to expect.
So it's not clear if order one or not, that really suggests
that. Right.
All right, great. Well, if you have time, let's go up there.